to do really, probably, I'm guessing it'll take today and the next time, which I guess will be Tuesday, or the next time in the subject, is to focus on Yachloku, etc. Focus on Yachloku specifically. What does Yachloku mean? We've seen a little bit of an introduction as to the issue as a whole, that we're trying to resolve monetary conflicts. And how we resolve them, we have a whole menu of different choices, and we have different factors that may push us towards one or the other, depending on who it is who's saying what. And within that framework, I'd like to focus on trying to understand Yachloku specifically, which I assume will take us at least 2 days to try to map out all the issues and look at all the ramifications. Just 2 points to fill in from the previous day. One, we spent some time yesterday talking about Pshara, and Pshara may be a major element in how to understand Yachloku. One point I don't know if I had a chance to fully explain fully when we were talking about yesterday, Rav Soloveitchik's three interpretations of Tosfos. That Tosfos had said that perhaps even though Pshara and Din are linked, there is a key difference that maybe Pshara, you have to have a unanimous panel. That even though you have din, you can have, let's say, three dayanim, 2-1, and that'll be a fine verdict. But when it comes to pshara, you have to have a unanimous panel. So we mentioned three different interpretations that the Rav had offered in terms of why that should be the case, and how he preferred, really, the third interpretation, which was in the context of him seeing this as a din of lefnim mishuras hadin, essentially a ruling that is on a different track, a ruling that's not the strict letter of the law din, but is in this other realm or this other atmosphere of lefnim mishuras hadin. I don't know if we fully had a chance to explain why that should therefore take us to the conclusion that you should have a unanimous panel. So just to spend 2-3 more minutes just to explain that. So the way the Rav suggested is that if you have a machlokes between two people, and we're going to essentially vote for one side over the other, so you have a clash. You have a clash between Reuven and Shimon. And therefore, a bittul process, a process of rov, where one negates the other, helps us to decide who wins. So you have two votes for Reuven, one vote for Shimon. Reuven's side wins over Shimon's. Shimon's side is basically bottled, basically negated. So said the Rav, that only makes sense when you have a clash between A and B, and we have to figure out which one's going to win. But here, once we've switched over to Pshara mode, so that's not really what's happening. We're now trying to create a harmonious middle, so to speak, or a third alternative, as they say. And that, therefore, the whole mathematics of bittul, where one is negating the other, that no longer exists. That's no longer relevant. This is a little bit of evocative of Yoredei, by the way, the concept in Kashrus. Then we evoke the concept of bittul. So you need to have an actual clash between, let's say, Iter and Heser. Iter and Heter. You need to have two very different substances for one to negate the other. And sometimes if they're not different enough, then you don't really have a bittul, which is how some Rishonim understand the concept of davrashiyeshal matiri, that, the idea that if one substance is not, so to speak, fully usser, because it's going to eventually become mukter, you don't have a full clash. So in other words, a whole different subject. But essentially, in order for there to be a concept of bittul, for one side to win over the other and to negate the other, you need to have an actual clash between two sides. And maybe when we're talking about Pshara, so we don't really have that atmosphere anymore. That's not really what we're talking about. There is an additional element to bring up. Rav Yosef Engel. Engel was one of the great Gaonim of the 20th century. So among his fascinating svarim, he had a sefer called Beis HaOtzer. So the Beis HaOtzer is essentially an encyclopedia of Lumbus, where he goes through all of the Lumbusha topics in the world and discusses them in a Lumbusha fashion alphabetically. All the way up from Aleph to Beis. That's all we have. We only have the first two volumes. But the legend is that he wrote on all of it, and that somehow it got lost. It's really a tremendous loss to Klal Yisrael. The rest of the Beis HaOtzer, one of the
Rosh Yeshiva once suggested that if we had the entire base also, there'd be nothing left to say in, well, the contemporary Rosh Yeshiva, everything would be used up already, but like, he would have told us everything. But we have the first two volumes of Rosh Mengel's base also, whether the rest are lost or they're out there somewhere and they're just not being published, it's not clear. But in any event, so he discusses this as well, this Tosus, and he points out that when you're dealing with absolute din, so then you're establishing abstract facts, which become a part of legal precedent. And therefore, this whole system of Rove and all the rules that are a part of the din process, that's relevant to that type of scenario where you're going to establish abstract facts. What are the rules when Reuven is fighting with Shimon? And that'll go into your shelf as part of the Piskei Din, and that will be a precedent that will come up later. So then you have a concept of Rov. When you're dealing with Pshara, so you're invoking the unique facts of this circumstance and the unique surrounding factors, so then maybe the whole concept of Rov has less of a role. So it's a little bit of a different perspective on that. And again, just having some type of a background in Pshara is valuable now as we try to see how Yachloku may or may not draw on some of these principles. And again, also keeping in mind, we mentioned yesterday the view of the Netziv, that perhaps Beis Din may, in some circumstances, force Pshara, even though it sounds like from the Gemara like that's normally not the case, but maybe if accessing Din is not possible, maybe Beis Din would force Pshara. That's especially relevant as we try to think about Yachloku. That's part of it. You know, we're not normally evaluating the facts that can be a part of the canon of law. We're not dealing so much with abstract legal principles. We're dealing with accommodating the harmony of the situation. So it's a whole different system. It's a whole different language, essentially. So now to get into these factors that help us to decide. So over the past few days, we threw out some of the possible issues that push us in one direction or the other. Ochzen, there's a liar, if there is no liar, if it's possible to have truth. I think there are one or two criteria that weren't brought up in our discussion, so since they're going to come up today, just to make sure they're a part of our mindset as well. So also there's one phrase that appears in the Gemara and Bava Basra, which some of the Rishonim invoke as well, which we should be aware of, which is the factor of Ikka l'meikam ala demelso. Right? You see that expression in the Gemara and Bava Basra? Now, what does that mean? Ikla meikum alad demelsa? That's Aaron.
According to the passage
of Bavar,
what exactly happened?
Right. That basically, if the situation is such that maybe it can figure out what's going on, maybe enough is going to come up that the situation can be clarified. We don't know that our book is closed in terms of what we have. So that's also a factor that is taken into consideration in terms of why we pick one system or the other. And that's going to be invoked by some of the Rishonim that we'll discuss today, so that's also important to have as part of our mindset. There's also another factor that I don't think we spoke about so much in the past 2 days. It's an expression that you find in the Gemara as well. It's an expression called Zilusa de Beidina, which we also have to figure out exactly what that means. But on one level, it means that we're concerned about Beis Din's reputation or Beis Din's effectiveness, Beis Din's stature. There are a couple different ways to understand it. But it addresses the fact that we don't want Beis Din to say something that's going to be reversed, let's say. Beis Din is going to issue a ruling, and they are so limited in the information they have that it's going to perhaps have to be overturned. So that has bad consequences for Beis Din, and that also gets factored in terms of why we would pick one path or another, why Beis Din would get involved or not get involved, is the consideration of avoiding Zilusa de Beis Din. Do we worry about that? Do we not worry about that? It's a whole discussion with Gemara and Bava Basra. But that's also a factor to keep in mind. So with all of those introductions, so now let's talk about what some of the major Rishonim say in terms of distinguishing, let's say, between Yachloku and Arba. And so the easiest way to start with that, using easy in only one sense of the word, because it's a difficult Tosfos,
But Tosos and Bava Basra is perhaps the quickest stop to try to get a little bit of a survey of the possible issues. Tosfos in Bava Metzia, on the Daf Beis, says half of Tosfos in Bava Basra. And essentially, the position of Rabbeinu Tam in Bava Basra echoes the Tosfos that we have in Bava Metzia. So if we want to get the whole story, or at least the whole story in terms of Baliyat Tosfos, so if we look in Bava Basra, so we find what seems to be basically two opinions in terms of what is our preferred method. And on the one hand, we know the case of the talis, shnai moksim b'talis, so we split it with the shvua, yachloku. And in the case of the boat, so we have this mysterious kolda alam dvar, might makes right, or fight it out, or bring proofs, however we want to understand what's going on there. That's the policy for the boat. So Tosfos and all the Rishonim ask, why is there those two policies to begin with? So what's Rabbeinu Tam's view? Rabbeinu Tam's view is, what's the focus? The focus is Ochzen, right? The fact that, which Rashi emphasized, which a lot of other Rishonim emphasized, Rabbeinu Chananel is quoted by a lot of Rishonim as emphasizing, that because there is the aspect of Ochzen, that is the key issue. And it sounds like, based on the reading of the Gemaras together with the Rishonim, that Rabbeinu Tam's view is that really you need both. You need that it is a situation of Ochzen, and that it's at least conceivable. Chaluka Efsherli Osemes. Could be that there is a view in Rishonim that just focuses on Ochzen. Rabbeinu Chananel is quoted by a lot of the Rishonim as emphasizing Ochzen. And I don't know if you got a chance to see the Rashba, but the Rashba understands that Rabbeinu Chananel only cares about Ochzen. Doesn't care about Rama and Shulios Emes. As long as you have Ochzen, the policy is Yachol. Anyone get to see that Rashba? It's comes up in a few places. The Rashba understands Rabbeinu Chananel that way, that all we care about is Ochzen. And Rabbeinu Tam probably cares about Ochzen and Ramai together. But both of them emphasizing Ochzen as the key element. While the Riva in Bava Basra, the Riva doesn't seem to care about Ochzen. The Riva is also shared by a lot of other Rishonim. The basic rule of thumb, it's a kind of like hangman. If your name is spelled Reish Yud, blank, Beis, something, so then you hold this way. The Riva and the Ritzbah and the Ritzbam, or the Shittim Lukabetzas and Tosfei Rush, they quote a lot of other Rishonim that all have names that sound like that, that are all in the Riva club. Now, what does the Riva focus on? Focuses on Ramai. Right, that's all we care about. That in the situation of the talis, it's possible they're both telling the truth. It's possible they both picked it up at the same time. So therefore, we split it. Well, in the case of the boat, we know that that's not what's going on. We know that they're both fighting over one boat that is not shared, and therefore somebody's lying. So, kol da'alim gvar. That's essentially the view that comes out from Tosfos. There are a few other Rishonim as well who say other things, but as far as Tosfos is concerned, those are essentially the two perspectives, with again Rabbeinu Chananel possibly being in between. But if we take this range, so Rabbeinu Tam focusing on Ochzen and the Riva focusing on Ramai, so what exactly are they fighting about? What exactly is the Nekudas HaMachlokas? And there are a lot of ways to look at it. There are a lot of issues which could be hidden in this debate. But there's one aspect that's particularly interesting to focus on in light of what we addressed the past few days. This was an observation I also heard as I mentioned from our Mashkiach Rav David Miller Shlita, that if you look at the focus of Rabbeinu Tam and the Riva, so they come from what seems to be very different starting points. Tell me if you pick up something here and how they are phrasing it. So let's look at how, let's say, Rabbeinu Tam says it. Right, so Rabbeinu Tam wants to know, why are we not going to use Koldol and Gvar in Bava Metzia and Daf Beis? And he says, I'm reading from the third line of Tosus and Bava Basra on the Madal and Mebeis, Umafarish Rabbeinu Tam, the Ochzin Shiny, the Kevan Sheshnehem Muchzakin, Ein Lanu Laniach Sheyigzal Ha'echa V'chaveiro. Since each one has some kind of muchzak status, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes, what kind of status. So we can't allow a kol da'olam gvar situation, because that will result in one of them robbing the other. Since each one can claim some kind of muchzakos, so if we're going to declare a winner through kol da'olam gvar, so the winner is kind of stealing from the loser. Because it's considered as if we know that each of them has a portion in it. That everything we should leave it as in the presumption that it belongs to who is holding it. And he quotes the case of Naska the Rebava. Right, the Gemara there in Bava Basra is probably right before the part which I told you to look at. So the Gemara there talks about a situation where somebody was tried for grabbing an iron bar from somebody else's hand, and the presumption was the person who was originally holding it was the owner. The defendant said, yes, I grabbed it away, but it was originally mine. And we say to him, too bad, we saw the first guy holding it, we assume it's his. So says Rabbeinu Tam, we have a situation like that here. We have to figure out again what exactly he means by that. But it's as if each one has some claim to their half. So if we're going to let one guy beat up the other guy, he's going to walk away with the other guy's half. Jonathan?
If that would be the case, that if Tosfos' suspicion would be true, that we're taking away from someone who legitimately owns it, what did the Gemara call that, the Derora Mamona case then?
So that's a good question in of itself. Depends how you define Derora Mamona, of course. Apparently not. You know, apparently that's not what Derora Mamona means, even though it's a reasonable assertion that maybe it should mean something like that. So we'll see that the definition of each term is probably going to be interdependent then. So we have to wait to fully define both terms. And even this Rabbeinu Tam, there's still going to be a lot of room to try to see how far he's willing to go with what he's saying. But on the surface, he's saying, on some level, I am taking away from your rights. If I'm going to win, I'm going to beat you up and take the whole palace. It's as if I'm stealing from you. Now, that's Rabbeinu Tam's focus. The Riva's focus is that we can't do Yachloku, because Yachloku will be rewarding a Rama, or will be endorsing Ramos, or is inherently flawed. Different ways of looking at what the issue is of the presence of a liar. So, do you see a major difference in just the way the question is being asked between Rabbeinu Tam and the Riva? It's an interesting thing if you think about it. You see something very different in terms of where they're coming from? Adam, I think it looks like you have something in mind.
Is it that Rabbeinu Tam is focusing more on, like, what's going to happen with the people themselves, and Riva is focusing on what will happen to the reputation of Bezdin?
So that's interesting. It could be, you know, and if you look for the Sifrei HaAchronim, there are many suggestions as to what's animating this issue between Rabbeinu Tam and the Riva. So that's also a valid point, although you could argue that Bezdin is also affected from Rabbeinu Tam's point of view as well. If Bezdin becomes the enforcement agent for Gazlanim, so then that's also not so good for their stature or the way they pass him.
Yeah, but is that being emphasized, though, by the sheet of Rabbeinu Tam?
Maybe. You know, maybe he says, "Ein lanu lahaniach sheyigzol echad l'chaveru," that we, now the Bezdin who's involved, shouldn't allow this gazela to take place. Maybe. But you might be right. Maybe it's just have to figure out whether or not that's fully there. I think Ephraim was up first, and Jonathan?
It looks like the Rivar is more worried about the liar getting more than he deserves.
It's also interesting. Right? That's also a question of what is our key responsibility. Right? So we have to again figure out what the issue is with the Ramai. Why are we so worried about the Ramai? So you could say that Ramai is an issue of Shalo Yehei Chote Niska, right? We don't want to reward a sinner. especially Beis Din should not be in that position. So maybe, is that our focus? What are we more worried about? If something's going to get messed up here, who should get messed up? And you know, there's a whole discussion, there's a famous line that it's a question who first said this, but you know, they say better that in America, so there's a presumption of innocence, because better that 10 guilty men go free than one innocent man be convicted. So in Jonah Goldberg's most recent book, he has a whole chapter devoted to where that comes from and if it's true and how the math works out exactly. But the question is, what exactly is our key priority? Is our key priority making sure innocent people don't get convicted, or making sure guilty people do get convicted? In a justice system, clearly there's a balance, but where are we going to tilt it? And where does it, so this question, where do you get that math from? That, oh, better 10 people should go free than one innocent man get convicted. Obviously, there's a lot of math you have to figure out how you get to that. So here, too, what are we more interested in? Are we more interested in making sure that the liar doesn't profit, or are we more interested in making sure that the innocent don't lose out unnecessarily? Especially once you get into Yehemunach, you get that issue, because once you say Yehemunach, it seems like we're more interested in making sure the liar doesn't profit, because they both lose out. And that's something we'll get into a little bit as well. So I think that's also an interesting distinction. Again, everything anyone's going to say is probably going to be valid, because there's a lot of nuances here in terms of Rebbein Yitam and the Riba, and many suggestions as to what's addressing it. So I think all of these points have a lot to be said for them. Jonathan?
I was going to say something very similar to that.
Something along those lines. Well, the more so, because now it has double significance. So all of these points have validity. Aaron?
Didn't we say that Rebbein Hanan also got all the curious about focusing?
That's what it seems like. Yeah, that's how the Rashba.
Doesn't Tosfos say at the end that the Rebbein says,
yeah, so we didn't get into that complicated point at the end. Tosfos says, and now there's another level as well. So we'll have to, that brings in a whole different, probably a whole different category of Echlokos. We'll have to discuss that separately.
Where's Rebbein there is quoting?
Well, there's no, the same Tosfos, yeah. When there's Tosfos, Rebbein comes up twice. First, the Rebbein says that we just care about Ramai. And then he says also, but if you don't have to be Ofsin. But if you are Ofsin, we didn't explain this yet, but he says that he doesn't require Achiza, but if there is Ofsin, if they are, then he's even willing to be even more Megal, so to speak. So we'll have to discuss that separately. But before he says that clause, so this is his initial position. So there is something else here which is very interesting to focus on in terms of how they're asking their questions. What do they seem to assume should be the ideal policy? Is there a difference there in terms of how they ask the questions? Because it seems like Rebbeinu Tam really wants to do a Kol Da'olam Gvar. And the Kol Da'olam Gvar should be the policy. But what does he say? Look, we can't allow it here. We've got a problem. We have a problem that if Beis Din is going to allow Kol Da'olam Gvar, so then they're essentially signing off on something akin to gezeilah, that they're going to be violating the muchzak nature that is present here. One person is going to be taking away from somebody who has some type of muchzakos. We can't allow that. So it sounds like Rebbeinu Tam is preferring the kol da'olam gvar as the default option, but sometimes there's something stopping us from doing it. So if we didn't have muchzak, if we didn't have ochzin, we'd love to say kol da'olam gvar. But we can't, because two people are both holding on to it. So in other words, Baba Basra, that should be our rule of thumb. And unfortunately, sometimes we can't do it because of the thumbs, because of the holding. So then we'll have to say afloku instead of what we really want to say. While the Riva is perhaps coming from the opposite, right? Because the Riva seems to be saying, what would we like to do? What should our policy be? Yachloku. But why can't we do Yachloku? Because of the Ramai issue. Again, however we define it, we don't want to reward the Ramai, we don't want to do something which is inherently impossible. However you want to understand the Ramai issue, we're held back from doing Yachloku. So that's an interesting point, right? So it seems like that there is this key philosophical difference as to what is our desire. Do we want to do kol da'olam gvar, except when we can't? Or do we want to do yachloku, except when we can't? Hi.
Hi. There's yachloku in the case of a machlokes bar v'chamer,
mm-hmm.
and there's no And according to Rabbeinu Tam, who says you need Efshir Liyosemes, over there it's not possible that it half belongs to each
correct.
One. So how is there...
So one thing we'll also see as we go a little further is that it could be there's different types of Yachloku. That maybe there is Yachloku that can be MS, and maybe there's another type of Yachloku that's on a different system. So we have to see where the power of the Chamor fit into that equation. So it's possible that maybe there is a... We'll see in a few minutes, right, that maybe there's a couple of other angles to Yachloku. It depends on what kind of situation we're talking about. But it's on the surface, definitely a very powerful question. That certainly doesn't seem to be actually also MS. However, on the other hand, it's also not a Rami situation. And maybe that's the key issue.
Because they're both Shammah.
Right, because they both don't really know what's going on. So that's also something we have to try to figure out. And again, it's a frustration of this topic, it's a beauty of this topic, that everything is so intertwined, every term has so many different possibilities. So we're not sure if MS and Rami are the same issue. That it could be that maybe if we're just concerned about rewarding a Rami, so then if there's no liar, and we'll see a lot of support for this view, then we're not so worried about the Chalukah, even if the Chalukah can't be MS. Even if we know the Chalukah is not true, as long as we're not rewarding an intentional liar, maybe we're not so afraid about that. So maybe Rabbeinu Tam could live with that. And that's something we'll have to see a little bit more about in a few minutes. Okay, so that's a very interesting point, right? So then that all plugs in to what we were talking about during our introductory phase. What is our key interest? Would we rather do Yachloku, or would we rather do Kol Dolom V'Lav? Now, if that is a question, so how could you understand that question? Why would I say, what type of person or what type of attitude would prefer Kol Dolom V'Lav, and what type of attitude would prefer Yachloku? What would push me to idealize one system over the other, right?
In a case where you wouldn't want to involve basement, basement is not a default. You shouldn't settle disputes by going to basement. If you have to, then you have to.
So you're entering into yet another machlokas, right? The question of what the kol dalam gvar is, right? So if kol dalam gvar means Bezdin just walks away and lets them kill each other, essentially, so then if you prefer kol dalam gvar, you're saying that maybe it's a preference to keeping Bezdin out of things, right? But of course, as we see that, and we haven't yet addressed head on, kol dalam gvar might not be a siluk of Bezdin, may not mean that Bezdin is walking away. It might be an actual judicial process, right? It might be that they each come and they bring proofs and they try to outweigh the other until one wins. So if you see it that way, and obviously it's all going to hinge on how you understand what the different things mean, but if you understand that Kol Dolom Gvar is a process, so then you could say, listen, Kol Dolom Gvar is more if I believe that Bezdin should find the winner, Bezdin should find the truth. So perhaps this is something that will take me to a victor. That's Bezdin's prime interest. Well, if I believe that Bezdin is more interested in Pshara, I saw the Machlokas in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, so then maybe Yachloku is more consistent with that idea. That Yachloku is more the harmony psak and less the likely to be the actual psak. And even if we insist on a chaluka l'cholios emes possibility, so we know that we say chaluka l'cholios emes, we really mean a very theoretical realm. Because what are the odds that it actually is emes? And yes, it's possible that these two people picked up the garment at the exact same time. But does that mean we actually think that's probably what happened? That's the basis behind yachloku? Presumably not. And presumably, Yachloku doesn't mean that we really think that that happened. But that it's possible because it's conceivable. As opposed to a situation where there's no scenario in which it could happen. So therefore, Kol Dolom Gvar, if you understand it as a judicial process, maybe is more about finding an actual true winner. And we'll see that there are Rishonim who really do see Kol Dolom Gvar in that sense. Right, like you saw the Rush, because that was already on the Mar Makom of the Rush in the first Siman, does see Kol Dolom Gvar as a real process of looking for the truth. While if you focus on Yachloku, you're probably less interested in truth and more interested in Pshara, in something that is along those lines. And I heard also from Rav Miller quoting Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, that when it comes to Yachloku, you are 50% right 100% of the time. And when it comes to Kol Dal Mgvar, you're 100% right 50% of the time. Not exactly, but statistically, you know, if you flip a coin, so the Kol Dal Mgvar, you'll probably get the right winner 50% of the time, 100%. With Yachloku, you're unlikely to really get the real winner, because the chances that they both are equally right is slim. So you're half right all the time. You're each giving the each time you give the winner half of what he deserves to get. So that's really a very good way to sum it up. That essentially, what's better for us? What would we rather do? Would we rather be 100% right half the time, or would we rather be half right all the time? And that seems to be the two different models. Why would I prefer Yachloku or Kol Dal Mgvar? What would I rather? I'd rather all the time be half right, or I'd rather half the time actually get, so to speak, the real MS, the real truth. And maybe that's why I'll say, let them fight it out, let one person win, and hopefully, statistically, my process will work half the time at least. That's possibly a very interesting way to look at it. So, it's interesting, if you look at the Trumas Hadeshim, which was on today's list, I don't assume necessarily that too many people got to it, and we provided, thanks to the fine work of Jonathan and Mike, we provided copies, so you should be able to access it more easily, but it's a longish tshuva. It's really one passage that I wanted to highlight, so it's good that we get a chance to discuss it before most people have seen it, so you'll know what to really focus on. There's one line in the Trumas Hadeshim which is very interesting to this specific point. So Trumas Hadeshim says as follows. And this is really a good segue into another major issue here. If we are going to call the two parties muchzar, if we're going to say that the two people who are holding on to the talis, each one has a claim, so we have to figure out, as we've been kind of hinting at, what do we mean? We mean they're really muchzak? We mean that they really have legal title, so to speak, to what they're holding? And that the whole force of the presumption of havacha is on behalf of this person holding half the talis? Or is it something less than that? There's some edge that they get because they're holding on to the edge. But it's not an actual muchzakos. It's not the same thing as somebody who's really got something in his pocket. Somebody who has, say, a cheskes marakama, and we know that he owned the house. Yeah, there are other factors in halacha maybe that are stronger. Maybe this is really a weak kind of muchzak. So that's something we certainly want to spend some time figuring out. But the Trumas Hadeshim picks up on this issue, and Trumas Hadeshim says as follows. He says, really, this is not a real muchzak. This is a very weak point. But what's its purpose for us? It's enough of a something that we shouldn't say Kol Dal Mgvar. It's enough of a basis to give some type of stature to each side, so you shouldn't say Kol Dal Mgvar. Because he goes on to say that Kol Dal Mgvar is like Dina de Barsoi, the rulings of the Persians, which the Gemara at the end of Baba Basra talks about, and presumably he's referring to one line in that Gemara in Baba Basra, where the Gemara says that the Dina de Parsoi, Persian justice, they give rulings and they don't explain what they're doing. So that's presumably what he's saying, that there's something very ambiguous, very unsatisfying from a justice perspective about Kol Dal Mgvar. So Ochsen helps that we have some reason now to split it between the two of them. It gives some type of equal stature between the two. It doesn't necessarily create actual muchzak in halacha, but it's something. So now we don't have to say Kol Dal Mgvar. So I thought that was very interesting because it's even more explicit, let's say, than either Rabbeinu Tam or the Riva in expressing a preference. And we have to read into these Rishonim and Tosfos to see that they're coming from a premise of preferring one or the other. But here the Truma Sadashin really seems to say it pretty clearly. He says, we don't like Koldal and Gvar. Koldal and Gvar is the law of the jungle, perhaps, in his understanding. So if we have to, we have to. But if we have any basis to take things in a different direction, we prefer that. So we call it Mukhsak here. So all we mean is that there's enough to say we can now split it between the two. David?
Why does he feel that this Mukhsakus isn't particularly real?
So that's something we're going to have to figure out. What exactly is this Mukhsakus? Here, so you have two people holding on to something. So first of all, it's going to be a discussion with Gemara later on in the first parak. How are they holding on? Are they holding on to the edges? Are they holding on to more material? How are we going to decide that one person is holding on to half, let's say, more than the others? Let's say if each one is holding on to an edge. So now we could argue that each one only is covering the part that he's holding and the rest is no man's land. Or we could say that normally if I pick up something from the edge, so then I'm considered to be mukhzak on the whole thing. But here you have two people from the edges, so we could say maybe they're each mukhzak on the whole thing. And then that undermines the other one's mukhzakos, because how can two people in a mutually exclusive way be mukhzak on the same thing? So there are a lot of reasons to question just how much significance do we want to put on the fact that somebody's holding something when another person has the exact same identical claim. And we'll get to a little bit also, Rabbi Hanan talks about this. You know, what do we mean when we say mukhzak? If we say mukhzak, do we mean that each one is mukhzak in the whole thing and then they have to somehow reconcile that? Or each one is mukhzak in half? And then what's our basis for saying half, essentially? Because that's the claim? So there's a lot of elements that could undermine this chazaka. It's not as, on the surface, it's not as solid as a normal everyday chazaka, perhaps. So that's how the Truma Sadashin certainly understood it, and he explains a couple of dinim based on that. And in the context of saying that, he says, so it's not real mukhzak, but all it does is it saves us from koldal and gvar. Koldal and gvar is not so ideal, so yippee, we have some reason not to say it. Okay, I think Alicia's first time there.
Does he agree with the Riva that it's not that our preferred policy would be Yachloku?
So that's what it seems like. It seems that he's, I mean, as opposed to any third choice.
Well, he does. He doesn't agree with the.
Right. If we're reading Rabbeinu Tam and the Riva correctly, you know, so you have to interpret them a little bit. So the value of the Truma Sadashin is he's much more explicit in kind of disparaging Koldal and Gvar. So it seems like he's for sure on the don't prefer Koldal and Gvar team. So since that's how we're understanding
it, for Yachloku, or?
That's what it seems like, at least in terms of that. But you know, well, there are other elements which could sometimes push towards other things, but between Yachloku and Koldal and Gvar, he seems to think that Yachloku is more humane, let's say, or more civilized than Koldal and Gvar. Okay, so I think the Truma Sadashin is very interesting, and we'll have to also now explore a little bit more what this mukhzak status could mean or might not mean. Hi, sorry.
I mean, I guess the possibility of why it's not full mukhzakos is because generally you're mukhzak on the whole thing, and your tefisa is just you and the contradictory claim, but here there's something shver in and of itself. The tefisa itself is not full. You claim the whole thing, you're only holding out to half.
Well, that, you know, could be okay if there was nobody else fighting you. But here,
right? Since he's fighting you, so your claim contradicts your tefisa.
Right. Well, your claim doesn't by itself contradict your tefisa, but your claim is more broad than your tefisa because your claim is on the whole thing. And your tefisa,
right.
You'd like to claim your tefisa is on the whole thing, but your tefisa is also equal to somebody else's tefisa. So we can't credit yours without crediting his equally so, and they're mutually exclusive. So then. That leaves us in a little bit of a difficult position. Okay, so that difference is very interesting. It's also worth noting, just before we leave the question of what the various Rishonim say, that the Rashba, we mentioned the Rashba a few minutes ago as understanding Rabbeinu Hanan in a certain way, but the Rashba himself, he also says that he thinks the issue is that the phrase the Gemara has of Ikkel Amekam Alod the Milsa. That if you could eventually figure it out, if let's say there's potentially enough proof out there, you don't know, the evidence hasn't been gathered yet, and there's a good reason to believe that if they duke it out, the truth will emerge, so then that's a reason to go do kol de olam vavim. But in the case of this talis, so it's pretty safe to imagine that you have the whole story here. This was a talis that was lost on the ground. Two people each claimed to be the person who picked it up. So how much more do you think is going to happen? You think there's going to be a shtar that's going to turn up somewhere? You think there's going to be security footage that's going to turn up? I mean, what do you think is going to happen that's going to establish this any further? So it's likely that this is the whole story. These are all the facts that you have in front of you. And in the case of the boat, so then, as the Gemara over there invokes that phrase, that, who knows, the person claims to own a boat, so then all kinds of people could come forward and talk about the history of the boat. And there could be shtaros of sale, and there could be all kinds of proof out there that will establish one person as more credible than the other. So the Rashba understands that that's really the key issue. Which, if that's the case, so then how does that characterize the two possibilities? If we say that if Iklamekim Aladim Elsa will do Kol D'Olam Gvar, and if not, we'll do Yachloku, so how does that give us any kind of a perspective on these two possibilities? I think it seems to say that really there's something better about Kol D'Olam Gvar. We'd rather try to reach that full truth. If we have the possibility of getting to a correct psak, so to speak, we'd rather let that happen. But if we're hit at that end, if we know that this is not going to be any more proof, we have a Shnaim Ofs and Batalis that they found, so then, all right, we're stuck, so Yachlok. Now, if that's the case, so that's a good premise then to ask the question. And this is a question all of the Achronim get involved in one way or another. And we'll try to present it in a way that includes all of their perspectives. What is the Psak of Yachloku? And of course, as we mentioned before, it could be there's more than one Yachloku, and that we'll have to also keep that in mind. But before first saying that there's more than one Yachloku, so at least let's say the Yachloku of Shnaim Ofs and Batalis. What's the nature of that Yachloku? And you could say it a number of ways. You could say that it's essentially a psak. And you could say that it's even a psak of vadai. That Bezdin is ruling, it's half for this guy and half for that guy. Now we call it vadai. Does that contradict what we said a few minutes ago, that it's highly unlikely that this really is the case? No. What we mean by vadai is not vadai that it's definitely the history, but vadai that the psak is issued in definite terms. That the halacha, under the circumstances, assigns 50% to this guy and 50% to that guy with the language of vadai, in definite terms. Alternatively, you could say that no, this is not a psak, but this is essentially a pshara. We have a dead end, and this is, works very well with the Rashba that we just said a second ago. And especially if you take the Rashba together with the Netziv that we mentioned yesterday. Right? Remember what the Netziv said about Pshara and Bezdin forcing it? So the Netziv against the Meshech Chachma, if you remember from yesterday, the Netziv said that sometimes Bezdin will force a Pshara. In the Gemara, in Sanhedrin, it says that the Bezdin is supposed to ask the guys, do you want Din or do you want Pshara? And it's up to the Bali Din. And Meshech Chachma assumes that it's always up to the Bali Din, even though sometimes it's really in their best interest to go for Pshara. But the Netziv wrote in his Tshuva that sometimes a Bezdin will force Pshara. If Din is impossible, then they'll force Pshara. So if that's the case, it could be plugged right into the story here. And especially take together what we just said from the Rashba with that Netziv. So what did the Rashba say, right? That if you could figure it out eventually, if there's potential, the truth will come out. Go for Kol D'Olam Gvar. If there's no potential, go for Yachloku. So meaning what? Maybe it means there's no way you're going to figure out the Din Emes here. So force the Pshar. So then, that's the only mahalach. We only have a pshara because we have no access to truth beyond what we have in front of us.
So then maybe Achloku is essentially a pshat. So that's a question the Achronim ask. Many of the Achronim, very extensive literature on this, ask this question, is Yachloku a psak, or is it a pshara? And if it's a psak, is it a psak of vadai? Or is it a psak of safek? We're not claiming that this is the whole story, we're not claiming that this is even a final characterization of what the halacha is, but with the less brayra, we have no other avenues to take, and we don't know what the story is, so the best approach is let's leave everybody half happy. Aaron?
I'm going to consider it psak of vadai. Both are claiming that it's both theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they're not, even though it's possibly lifted it at the same time, and so they're one of them claiming it got there first, but at the same time, they're two completely contradictory timers, and they're
so you're raising an important point. The question: to what extent? And this is something we'll also have to get into in more detail. To what extent does the psak have to correlate to the timers, which is going to be an important issue in terms of yecholios emes? Is also an important issue. But here, the fact that they want each one wants it to be totally theirs, so it doesn't take away from the fact that the reality could genuinely be that it's 50-50. Even though each one would like to say, this could come up in all other areas of civil dispute. Right? So in general, especially in an advocacy culture, we have lawyers advocating on each side. So the premise of any type of monetary dispute is everyone's going to push for as much as they can get. Not necessarily where there are questions of fact. You have a dispute between a landlord and a tenant. Right? So who has to pay for the plumbing? So I have all the reasons why I think I'm the landlord, I have all the reasons why I think the tenant should pay, and the tenant says he has all the reasons why he thinks the landlord should pay. Nobody's lying, they're just all picking the elements that go in their favor. And then the court says it's 50-50. So he's not agreeing with either party, but it still could be a true psak. He could say that this is what the law really is, that the law dictates that the plumbing is 50% the responsibility of the tenant and 50% of the landlord, even though neither one wanted it that way, but that's what the law really is. And that's a true law. It's not a, maybe that doesn't come out of any kind of stuff. It comes out of this is the way we assess responsibility. So it could be that that's true here, that, okay, under the circumstances, we have two people asserting claims on one object. There's no legal basis to give one person over the other. So then the law now legally says it's half yours and half yours. And that is our final vadai statement. Hi.
Even if you want to say that this case is Pesharif, it would still be that one in a million case where they legitimately did both pick it up at the same time, so then it would be din, then it would be, so this mission is talking about both Peshara and maybe...
Well, if you knew that, right, so then you wouldn't need a bezin at all. Let's say if we had witnesses,
right,
and we saw, or they, you know, like they happened, if it really happened, then they actually probably both know, right? So if they both came at the same time, that's a very big talus, right? So if it's a normal-sized talus, they probably both saw each other pick it up at the same time. Right, so then, yeah, that taka would be the case. Right, so then, if two people find something and they have equal claims, so then presumably al pidin they split it, and that actually is the genuine, both the psak shel vadai and the actual facts.
Right.
So, but here we're saying we didn't see that that really happened. But the only information we'll ever have is what we have in front of us. So maybe Bezdin Paskins, the rules of Vados, that's it, 50-50. That's how the halacha tells us. Or maybe not. Maybe it's some type of a pshara that, for the less bravery, we don't have a choice, so we will push things in that direction and we'll say, better that they should split it. So this could, of course, also correlate to Rabbeinu Tam and the Riva. And that perhaps, and this is how some Achronim suggest as well, and many say that if you focus on ochsin as a requirement, ochsin is a way of giving some basis to say that each party has a genuine claim, and therefore there's some truth to saying it's 50-50. While if you're not interested in ochsin, like the Riva doesn't seem to care about ochsin, at least in his first premise. He's interested somehow, but he doesn't require Oksan. So then, maybe you're saying that essentially it's a pshara. Because if you don't have Oksan, right, so then what reason is there to say that it should be 50-50?
I have two people with competing claims. So, okay, so maybe one's right, one's wrong. Well, what's the basis to split it? If you're ever going to invoke Yachloku without Ochsin, like Rabbeinu Tam seems prepared to do, so then it's most likely that it is a Pshara that is at play. That's Riva. Riva seems prepared to do, and we'll discuss in a few minutes, it's possible the Rambam also seems prepared to say that. So then that probably is Midine Pshara. Now let's say you do require Ochsin. Right? Does that mean necessarily one thing or the other? You still could, if you want to drive yourself crazy, you could still try to figure out what is the significance of Ochsin. And there is an essay about this in the Sefer Kontrasei Shiurim. If you're familiar, Hagon HaGadol B'Shul Zev Gusman, who passed away 20 years ago, a little more, is the author of the Shiurim that were published in the Sefer Kontrasei Shiurim. So he notes that even this requirement of Ochsin, as we've already kind of seen, can be understood in a number of ways. But Shlomo, did you have a question? Sorry, I thought you had your hand up. So that itself, you could say that Ochsin creates a chazaka somehow, and therefore, again, it's each one's right to 50%. Or you could say, no, it doesn't create a chazaka for the reasons we've brought up so far. For whatever reason, it's not a perfect chazaka. But what does it do? It at least creates a suffix. If we have two people physically holding something, so then we don't know. And maybe that's enough to justify, let's say, in a sumchasin world, right? Maman amutl b'safek yachlok. And so we've seen in general in the Gemara that there is a range, that there is, let's say, a sumchas view that is more ready to say maman hamutl b'safek yachloku. And there is a chachamim world that tends more towards hamotzi mechavero olav haraya, that we're not going to split without proof. But you have to figure out when you cross from one area into the other. So maybe essentially, if I have two people both holding something, if we insist on ochsin, what does that accomplish for us? Not a chazaka. But to tell us that now I have a legitimate suffix. I have two people who are both holding something. That shows that I really don't know who owns it. So it's a suffix without another mutzak. So then it's enough to justify a policy of maman hamutl b'safek yachloku, to say that it's a suffix and let's invoke suffix policies. That's the whole question of what is yachloku, even if I do require ochsin. If I don't require ochsin, so then it sounds really like it's a pshar. It sounds really like it's a compromise. But if I do require ochsin, so then still, maybe it's because it really shows us something. Or maybe it's because it's enough that itself creates a suffix, and now I'm using suffix rules. Is everyone following so far? And this is very complicated stuff, so please do not be shy. Anything I can explain again? Anything should restate? That's a yes, I should explain again? Okay, so I'll just to clarify the points. So essentially, we want to know, what does the yachloku mean? Right, so we have a policy of yachloku. So is yachloku an actual judgment? Or is it a compromise? Is it a pshara? We'll use that word, right? Is it a pshara? So you could see it both ways. You could see it, especially if you focus on the Rashba's point that we invoke it when we're never going to find out anything more. It's a dead end. And then it's Ziv's point that in the dead end you force a pshara. So then, yeah, maybe that's what's going on here. Force a pshara. On the other hand, you could say, no, it's an actual din. We have two people with equal claims. 50-50 is a genuine din. So if you say that we require ochsin as opposed to not requiring ochsin, that could be relevant. If you don't require ochsin, so it's very hard to say this is anything but a pshara. It's probably a pshara if you don't require actual stature here. But even if you do require ochsin, so then you could say ochsin because that creates muchzak, and now people are actually deserving of the half. Or no, ochsin is enough to confuse things, so now you have a suffik. And a suffik will split it out of suffik. It's still a psak of bezdin, but it's a psak that is generated by suffik, and therefore, why do we care if we call it suffik? Because what if other things come up? What if I have other reasons to assign something to one party or the other. And we'll have to fill that in next time because it's a longer discussion. But if you say it's a Safek, let's say, for example, one of them is the Marakama. The one of them I know used to own it. I have two people fighting over one thing they both hold me. And I know that yesterday one of them owned it. So then, should that tilt the scales? What do you think? So it might depend. This was a point that was made by Aaron Yaffin, who was the Navardika Rosh Yeshiva. I have a sefer at home, which I'll probably refer to from time to time, called Netzer Matai, which was a sefer Zikaro that somebody published once, where he collected a lot of unpublished writings on Bava Metzias. So in that volume, the Navardika Rosh Yeshiva, Aaron Yaffin, made this point that normally, the fact that somebody owned something yesterday, Cheskes Marakam, that's not enough to give them stature today. If I have a Mukhzor versus a Marakama, one person clearly is possessing it, and somebody else possessed it yesterday, so who wins? The person who possesses it now. Mukhzor is much stronger than Marakama. So let's say I have these two guys fighting over a talis, and I know that one guy owned it yesterday. Does that tilt the scales at all? Well, if they're real mukhzak, then no, because Marakama doesn't affect the mukhzak. But if it's not that they're real mukhzak, it's just we don't know, so it's a suffix, so let's split it. So then maybe this could tilt things. Maybe the fact that he owned it yesterday, that gives a few extra points in his favor, so now maybe it's not so much of a suffix anymore. So it could make a difference. What's the nature of the Siach Loku? The Siach Loku is real? Or is it based on a suffix? It's based on a policy because we have no other information, so we'll do what we can. Again, if there's anything I should explain again, please let me know. I know this is complicated stuff, so be happy to state it again. But maybe we'll just make one more point, and then we'll try to recap what we have, and we'll continue this next week. It's interesting. You can find the following difference. If we talk about, let's say you invoke the factor of chaluku yecholios emes, right? That yachloku has the benefit in a situation where it could be true. As opposed to, let's say, what other case was brought up as a challenge to yachloku? Manashlishi. Right, so Manashlishi, we know that the policy is, and again, if you remember this case, you have two people who both gave a third party, Reuven and Shimon both gave Levi money to watch. Reuven gave $200, and Shimon, well, one of them gave $200, and one gave $100. So Shimon has $300 for two people. No, sorry, Levi has $300 for two people. He doesn't know who gets the third hundred. So what happens to that third hundred? Do we split it? No, apparently not. We let it stay in escrow forever until Leo comes and clarifies. Yehi Muna. So why is that different? So Tosfos focuses on the fact that it's basically not Yechol Leos Emes. That it's essentially unlikely that while the third guy was watching it, that one party transferred title to the other party. Presumably, there's no true split here. One party really owns 200, and one party owns 100. Is it mukhzak, by the way, in this case? Manashlishi, is that called mukhzak? So Tosfos says it is, right? And other Rishonim probably disagree, like the Riva. Like the Riva doesn't think it's mukhzak because neither party is holding on to it. Tosfos thinks it's mukhzak. Why? Because the Shomer is on their behalf, which is an interesting concept. So let's say it's mukhzak, but you can't have a genuine, real split. The Rush formulates it a little differently. If you saw the Rush throws in a different phrase. What does the Rush say? It says they can't split it between the two of them. Why not? Because what? Sorry?
You're stealing from the other one.
Right, well, that's also what Totos was mentioned in terms of the talus.
Initially, but the guy knew that one guy had 100.
Exactly, that's the key phrase. David mentions that the Rush throws in, it sounds like he's saying like Tosfos, but he says this additional phrase that the original Shomer knew that it was not belonging to both of them equally. The Shomer knew at some point that one guy had 200 and one guy had 100. He just doesn't remember which one is which. Why do you care about that factor? What he knew once upon a time? Why is that relevant? Is that different than what Tosfos says? So the Stipler gone. The Stipler in the Kilos Yaakov, the Stipler says, he thinks what the Rush is getting at is that how much do we have to care about what this chazaka means? Is the chazaka just a legal presumption that whoever's holding on to it gets it? Or is it supposed to reflect some actual truth? When you see two people fighting over the talis, two people each holding half a talis, so is it enough that we say, okay, they're holding it, they get it? Or are we saying that it must reflect some actual historical reality that at least conceivably they both picked it up at the same time? That has to at least be an option. So the Rush, perhaps, he thinks that the chazaka has to mean something genuine. And therefore, even if you say that this is Bechezka's both of them, even if that's true, like Tosfos was saying, and like the Rush also seems to say, but we know that that chazaka does not reflect actual historical ownership. Because he knows that when they brought it in, one guy brought 200 and one guy brought 100. So since he remembers, he knew once upon a time that they had uneven amounts. So we can't allow this chazaka to create a split, because we know that it doesn't represent anything actually in truth. At least that's what the Rush is saying. Now, Tosfos doesn't necessarily go that far. Tosfos doesn't necessarily require it to reflect actual truth. But the Rush, by throwing that in, saying that the chazaka has to actually mean something, has to actually reflect genuine truth. All right, so we've said a lot of complicated ideas. Let's try to recap what we've spoken about. And again, please tell me if there's anything that's not clear. I'd be very happy to say it again, hopefully more clearly the second time. But essentially, what have we seen so far today? So we've seen that there is a debate as to when we use which policy. Rabbeinu Tam says we focus on Ochsin. If it's Ochsin, we do Yachloku. If not, we don't. And the Riva says we focus on if there's a liar. If there's a liar, so then we can't do Yachloku, we do Kol Da'olam V'ar. And we mentioned, as David Miller pointed out, that perhaps there's a premise here that Rabbeinu Tam would rather do Kol Da'olam V'ar, except that he can't because there is a chazaka of some type, an achiza of some type. And the Riva would rather do Yachloku, except that he can't because there's a liar who's going to be rewarded. So why would you prefer one or the other? So maybe the question is, do you prefer Kol Da'olam V'ar because it may get you to a genuine true ruling? Or do you prefer Yachloku because it's more harmonious, it's more the Mishpat Shel Shalom? In Rav Lichtenstein's words, would you prefer to be 100% right 50% of the time, Kol Da'olam V'ar? Or would you prefer to be 50% right 100% of the time, Yachloku? And then we saw that much more explicitly the Trumas Hadeshen shows a preference for not doing Kol Da'olam V'ar. Because he says that Ochsin, all that does is it gives you some reason to split it up. It's not a genuine chazaka. There's all kinds of weaknesses in the chazaka. But it's enough to say that we can split it justifiably without having to have recourse to Kol Da'olam V'ar, which is like Dina de Parsoi, which is not so nice, which doesn't really do it for us. And then we mentioned also that there is perhaps a view, the assumption was that Rabbeinu Tam requires both Ochsin and that there shouldn't be a liar. Rabbeinu Chananel, as the Rashba understood it, only cares about Ochsin and not about liars at all. And the Rashba himself is interested in Ikulam Eikam Alad Milsa, that if there could be more information that will clarify it, go for Kol Da'olam V'ar. And if there is no more information, you're at a dead end, go for Yachloku. So that helps us to then come to the question, what is Yachloku? Is Yachloku a Shara Bay? Maybe it is, especially in light of the way the Rashba just said it, that if you're at a dead end, go for Yachloku. And we saw that the Netziv says, if you're at a dead end, force a Pshara. So maybe Yachloku was a Pshara.
Or maybe not. Maybe it is a din vadai. Maybe it's a genuine ruling of Bezdin. So if you don't need ochzin, so then it really seems like it's a pshara. If there's no basis, nobody's holding anything, so then presumably it really is a pshara. If you do need ochzin, so then maybe it's a genuine psak, but maybe not. Right? Maybe ochzin creates a real chazaka, so it's a genuine psak. Or maybe ochzin just creates enough of a confusion. It's enough of a safek, because now we have two parties with equal claim. So okay, mamun amutu b'safek, now yachloku. So out of not knowing any better, we will divide it up. And the difference between a vadai psak and a safek could have an impact. Let's say, for example, there are other reasons to favor one party, but there are weak reasons. Like, for example, he owned it yesterday. So if we're just dealing with sfeikis, then maybe we'll give some weight to that. But if we're saying it's a genuine chazaka, then that chazaka is much more powerful than most other things. And then we consider the question of, does the chazaka have to reflect any genuine truth? And we mentioned the Stipler suggestion that maybe that's what the Rush thinks. Because the Rush, when he talks about Mana Shlishi, says even if you want to say that Mana Shlishi is a chazaka, that this extra $100 is considered to be mufsak through the agency of the guy watching it, but still, that chazaka doesn't help us so much. Because since the guy who took it, he knows that when they came to him, they had different amounts. So he knows the chazaka does not reflect any historical reality where they had an even amount. And if that's the case, you can't divide based on that. You can't make a yachloku when you know that the split will not reflect, by its very nature, a historical reality. And then you're forced into that third option of yehei munach, let's leave it until we see what happens. Are there any questions about that? Is that clear? Does that make sense? Happy to explain as many times as anybody would like. That was not a reason. Okay, so what we'll try to do is we have to now try to figure out a few more steps on how we can get some insight into this. Particularly, we have to look at the Rambam. Anyone should do Rambam in today's Rambam Kamos? Because hopefully tomorrow we'll have a lot more time to say.